Good afternoon and welcome to Results Matter Radio. I am Erin Mazars, Chief Marketing Officer and Director of Client Service for the law firm Burr & Foreman, and I will be your host for today's segment along with my co-host Lee Cantor, who is the CEO of Atlanta Business Radio X. If you are new to Results Matter Radio, welcome to the show. Our show was developed to bring you pertinent business information and offer real-life solutions to help drive desired results for you, whatever your business may be. Before we jump into today's segment, let me welcome my co-host Lee. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Erin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I am loving this hot weather.
You are. Dog days of summer. Is that what it is?
I am from Miami, Florida.
Yeah?
So it can't get hot enough for me.
Excellent. Well, then you should be really enjoying it.
I am.
Good.
Bring it on.
Well, let me tell you, Lee, we have a great show today, and I wanted to make it easy on you, so both of our guest speakers today go by Jim.
Good, so I won't mess up their names.
Let's hope not. We have Jim Stroud with us and Jim Hoover, who will be joining us to share a few tips on things physicians have in their control to ensure the success of their practice versus things that they may not have in control, i.e., what our government may be doing with healthcare. Mm-hmm. Good segment today. Healthcare is on every physician's mind. We thought today's discussion should focus on what physicians have in their control versus what they may not have in their control to help their business succeed. Jim Hoover joins us as a partner in Burr & Foreman's healthcare practice group and resides in the Alabama office of Burr & Foreman. Jim represents numerous hospitals, physicians, practices, pharmacies, and medical device manufacturers throughout Alabama and the Southeast. A few areas of concentration for Jim are litigation of Stark, anti-back, and anti-kickbacks and false claims violations, writing healthcare compliance programs responding to alleged EMTALA violations, which hopefully Jim can tell us what that is, Medicare appeals, and many other health law disputes. Jim Stroud joins us and is currently a member with the largest accounting firm in Alabama, Warren Averett Kimbrough & Marino, LLC. With over 35 years of accounting experience, Jim specializes in working with service businesses and medical practices in matters such as profitability improvement, physician compensation plans, staff training and motivation, recruitment of new physicians, and strategy exit of senior doctors. Welcome, gentlemen, to our show.
Hello.
Thank you.
We're glad you could join us. I tell you, it seems to me that, you know, with this new healthcare reform, that no class of American professionals will be more greatly impacted by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and the Healthcare and Education Reconciliation Act than physicians. Third-party payment arrangements already comprise the independence and integrity of the medical profession. Specifically, physicians will be subject to more government regulation and oversight and will be increasingly dependent on unreliable government reimbursement for medical services. Doctors already under tremendous pressure will only see their jobs become more difficult. You know, after I looked at those couple of paragraphs, Jim, you know, it dawned on me that I think there are probably two or three things that are priorities for physicians or things that they ought to focus on that will help them be successful in their business versus maybe what we've read a little bit about, you know, the Healthcare Reform Act. And I wondered if you might share with us today a few of those things that you think are top priority that and give them some tidbits that they can take home with them to help them be successful in their businesses when they're probably unfortunately focused on what's happening in government. So Jim Stroud, I'd love to start with you. What's top of mind for you?
I think the number one concern for them is an erosion of their profitability. Almost every physician that is our client will tell you that they are working harder and making less.
Mm.
And
does that vary by the type of
Medicine,
thank you. I almost said law because I'm so used to that. The type of medicine that they're involved in.
Great point. Some specialties are worse than others. I have a meeting with a group of physicians later this month where the aggregate pay cut for all four doctors will be over $500,000 if the second half of the year is, you know, the same as the first half in comparison to the previous year. And $500,000 pay cut is significant.
Very.
That specialty has been particularly impacted by changes in reimbursement, changes in utilization review, and a number of things. So, yeah, they're very concerned. All specialties, though, are subject to this. There almost won't be a doctor who does the same thing next year that he or she did this year who won't take a pay cut.
Okay. Wow, that's interesting.
It's brutal.
That's scary for people coming into the profession.
Well, and it's a combination of two things. It's a reduction in the revenues, and the revenues are based on reimbursements that the government or the insurance companies pay. And it's a function of the fact that the overhead goes up. Every employee wants a pay raise next year. They worked hard. They deserve a pay raise. The costs of doing business, you referred to the regulatory environment. Healthcare is got to be one of the most highly regulated industries in our nation. Probably the nuclear power industry is more regulated, but this one is pretty severely impacted, and new regulations come out all the time. So as soon as they think they've got a handle on the laws by which they have to operate, they have to address some newly issued set of regulations. But, and as a result, let me say this first, physicians are in either a point of malaise or anxiety or downright worry. And some of them are even saying, I think I'll just quit my practice. I had planned to in a few years anyway. I think I'll stop. I think our country is going to suffer an inadequacy of trained physicians in the years to come if we don't do something to give them some new encouragement. But the first area that they can do something about has to do with their reimbursements. And many people don't realize this, but a physician, everything a physician does in examining a patient is translated into a code, a numerical code, and that code is submitted either to the government or to the insurance company. And I think
so instead of like where, you know, lawyers write down exactly what it is they've done for the day and that's how their bills are done, this is just a code tells them exactly what was done throughout the day by that physician?
Exactly.
Okay.
For instance, if a physician is seeing established patients, that code for an established patient visit will either be a 99211, 212, 213, 214, or a 99215, depending upon the amount of work the physician did. And human nature is if there's a danger out there somewhere and you don't know exactly where the limits are, we tend to pull back. You know, we tend to be timid. And that timidity in medicine can be costly.
Okay.
Our most recent experience in this was a medical practice of four doctors where they were undercoding the actual visits that they could have coded for at a higher level for new and established patients. And the result...
Out of fear?
Out of just trying to keep their image below the profile that anybody would, any of the reviewers would.
So they didn't
want
to, like, have a red flag or somebody catching something.
That's a great term.
So they, like, erred on the side of caution and were underbilling.
Exactly.
Now, how did you even realize that? How would you even know that?
Well, there are two ways to detect it. Number one, and this is how we got the global picture, the CMS, the Center for Medicare Services, provides an average statistical set of numbers for each specialty. If you're a cardiologist or a urologist or an orthopedic, they'll tell you what their data says is the average dispersion pattern for your visit codes.
Right.
They won't tell you the numbers and how many patients you ought to be seeing because that varies from doctor to doctor, but they'll tell you the dispersion pattern. And when we compared these doctors, they're called evaluation and management codes, when we compared them to the average for their specialty, the lost dollars, not billings, lost dollars in the door, had they just matched the national average, they would have made an extra $1.6 million last year.
Wow.
Is that service that you provided that kind of caught that, is that above and beyond? Because that seems like you really had to know their business to even think to do that.
You do. One of the problems that we have when we're working with someone new and their current accountant, it doesn't do health care, and I know you have this problem, Jim Hoover, with attorneys who don't do health care. You have to acquaint them with the full service that comes with the provision of services where you understand these issues. But in this practice's case, it's been that way for years. There's no telling how many years they have lost.
And there's no making that up.
No, you cannot go back and get it.
And I think a lot of times practices are frozen by fear of what they might find, so they don't look. And you know, I tell my clients that code right, you want to do it right the first time, because if you bill too high, obviously you've got issues with the government and the payer. If you bill too low or code too low,
money.
Then you lose a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So it's worth looking at it.
And the coding right, you said there's a standard, so they should know how to code right.
They should. It is available. Thing about healthcare is it's a lot of small practices, one doctor, two doctor practices, and it's hard for them to afford the overhead, the added overhead of employing what's called a certified procedural coder.
Oh.
And so if you can't afford a CPC, then your next best effort is to become a student of it yourself, which many of them don't do. We find many times the youngest doctor in the group is the most knowledgeable about this because he or she just came from training.
Right.
The senior doctors struggle with it. So either somebody decides to become a champion of it or you have to go retain services to look at it.
So the doctors don't write the code. They just write what they did for the day.
But do they check a box? Don't they have a form that has a bunch of boxes and they just go down and check?
Some doctors will tell you they don't write the code, and Jim will tell you that that does not free them from the responsibility. I had a guy who used to be with the Office of Inspector General, which is the prosecutorial arm of, I guess, of all this, and he used to say that doctors said, you know, I don't pick those codes. And he would very quickly tell them, you can delegate that responsibility, that authority, that responsibility, but the authority rests with you.
You don't abdicate it.
Yeah. You do not. It sticks.
And also the government says, but you're also the one making the money off it. So there's absolutely no sympathy for trying to shrug off your responsibility as a physician to make sure it's correct.
Okay.
And I tell my clients, a lot of my physician clients, when they're going and joining a practice or the existing practice, and they're nowadays you see an employment agreements or personal services contract where the physician is responsible that if the practice has to pay back money from an audit because they overbilled the services, that the physician is responsible for indemnifying the practice. Oh. And I tell my physician clients that if you're responsible for indemnifying the practice, you better be able to look at and check those codes and have somebody reviewing those codes to make sure they're done right. Because at the end of the day, you can't say, well, I didn't know, because you chose not to look at it.
Right.
Couldn't they train their office managers to?
It's complicated, right?
They could, but the office manager is already under an overwhelming burden of to manage the staff, manage the patient throughput, make sure there's quality care given, make sure that every patient gets the right screenings that they're supposed to get. It's a daunting task to manage a medical practice. But to Jim Hoover's point, it's rarely an entire group of physicians that tend to exceed the limits. It's usually one in the group who's got a little bit of a push. And in those cases, we have some cases where that one doctor is put on what's called prepayment review, where to submit a claim at the higher level visit codes, they have to submit the chart copy. Every time.
Wow.
Because once you get caught at a documentation failure, you now enter the surveillance mechanisms that are pretty sophisticated.
And Jim Stroud raises an excellent point about doing it as a prepayment audit, because here's the problem that I think a lot of the doctors hear enough about that scares them to death, which is there's been some recent changes to the False Claims Act, which the False Claims Act will put you in jail for submitting false claims to the United States government. And if you do a post-payment audit and you find out that you've overbilled, then you have an obligation now under the False Claims Act, usually within about 90 days, it's considered an overpayment, and you have to make that repayment back to the government.
Oh, wow.
So it's one of those things that you got to be real careful of what you're looking for and how you do it. But that's why it's important to talk to Jim and use his services as far as how we're going to do an audit. What is it that you want to look for? You want to be accurate so you know what you're doing and what you're doing wrong. By the same token, you want to be careful what you find so that you can handle it.
And Jim Hoover, didn't that same law extend the liability to anybody who knows about it?
Like absolutely.
If an employee is aware of an overcoding tendency, and we've had practices where an employee became aware of a physician's...
like a nurse?
A nurse.
Or a front desk person, or
office manager. Anybody who knows the rules and is aware of it, and they can hold the physicians hostage.
And this is something the patient would have no awareness of, right?
No.
So the patient doesn't even know, like, oh, there's these extra five charges, or this code should really be a higher code or a lower code. The patient is clueless in this. So it's really up to the doctors and the doctor office to kind of manage themselves.
That's correct. The patient may see what's called an explanation of benefits, an EOB, that will have that code on it. But very few patients would be equipped to understand what the service they got and how it ought to compare with the
code. Like, if you were in a regular business and, you know, more traditional, if somebody put something in your bill, if you went to a restaurant and it said French fries and you go, I didn't order French fries, then you would flag it.
Well,
right
that's
away.
What I'm saying, like, with the lawyers have to write down exactly what they did. And
that's exactly, well, and two, you got to keep in mind that healthcare, not only is it one of the most highly regulated industries, it's one of the more unique industries. I mean, it's different. The person providing the service and the person paying the service is not always necessarily the same person. We have an employer that's paying part of the premium for the health care. You have the employee that's paying another portion. Then you have co-pays. You have deductibles. You have a third-party insurance company that's paying for it. And so by the time everybody gets through paying and coding and looking,
there's a lot of margin of error.
Absolutely. And us as patients and health care consumers, you know, they always say we're so uneducated because if a doctor tells us we need an MRI, well, we just have an MRI, you know.
Right.
But it's not like by the time you get done paying for it, what is it exactly you're paying?
Right, right. Well, other than the coding and the billing, I'm sure there are a couple other areas that we might be able to provide for our listeners as far as tangible things they can take back. What's another area that you think, Jim, where our physicians should be focused?
Well, there seems to be a declining appreciation for the medical community by our population in the country. I think healthcare is becoming more and more of a right rather than a privilege. And I'm not saying which of those two is the correct perception, but clearly as it moves into a rights status, patients are becoming less obedient with their doctors. The evidences of that are they will no-show appointments with some frequency. We're having almost epidemic no-show instances in our client base. I had one cardiologist who had five no-shows in a single morning of his clinic.
Could you pinpoint the type of no-show? Like, was it a particular type of patient, or
they are trying to get to the bottom of that now? And that's part of the analysis: is it a particular diagnosis patient? Is it a patient who owes us money already? Is it a patient from a certain day of the week? Is it a patient that's been referred by a particular doctor's office, and maybe that doctor's office doesn't try to hold patients to task on being timely and in attendance at a scheduled appointment? But you can do some drill down and find out what's happening, but that opportunity is lost. And so the profit goes away. The overhead stays the same, and now the physician just makes less money at the end of the day.
So for the day they had 10 patients, only 5 showed up. Cost of doing business is still the same.
Exactly.
Cost in their pocket less.
Right. So, but the no-show rate is only one example. Patients are less inclined to pay their balance, and you know, they tend to try to get out the door without the provision of their copay or their portion, their deductible share, and they don't follow clinical directions, and they're mean, they're rude to the staff. I did a little staff training session for a group one time where we talked about the insults that the staff take from at the hands of the patients, and they said they'll insult our intelligence, they'll insult our education, they'll insult our lineage. They, you know, I arrive at 7:30 and they want to know why I overslept, why I don't have coffee ready for them in the waiting room. They're just, you know, mean. This is not the way my brother had this procedure done in California, and they'll curse at the staff and speak unkindly to them. And your staff is all you have. A physician has a valuable asset in their people, and if they have to take care of them, and you can't let the patients abuse them. But that's happening.
So how do you handle that? What's your coaching and counsel?
Prune. You have to prune your patient list. You just can't take everybody who walks in the door. The problem is that you have good patients that are A-type patients that you would want to have every day,
right,
who sit in your waiting room for 3 hours waiting to see the doctor because they aren't trying to clean off some of the problem patients. And the problem patients are the ones, like I said, that don't follow. If you look at them, they're a combination of all those things. They're, you know, clinical problems. They don't follow your advice. They don't eat right. They don't take care of themselves. They're rude to your staff. They don't pay copays.
So they keep having to come back because they're not following what you're telling them to do to make them better.
Right. But of course
and then they're complaining because you're not making them better.
They don't take responsibility. That's right. It's somebody else's
fault. And then they're negatively impacting your good clients because they're making them wait and their
longer
behaviors
and longer
are impacting everybody.
Right. We tell our physicians, if you had a luncheon one day with just your staff and took nominations for which patients to terminate, it would be a fun, it's just a blast, you know.
I'm sure they have that list.
Oh, staff. Yeah. Please terminate Mr. Stroud. He is so mean.
But don't put that on Facebook.
So, Jim Hoover, can you fire clients?
You certainly can. Patients.
Patients. I mean, no, sorry, patients.
I don't fire my clients, but you can certainly fire a patient. Yeah, you can, and it's not overly difficult. It's something that I think runs against the grain that physicians have through their practice, but basically, as you would do anything else, you document it. You send them a letter. You tell them. You give them enough lead time. Now, the sticky point in terminating a patient-physician relationship is when you can do that. I mean, the biggest issue is you can't do it during an episode of care. Now, that becomes somewhat gray, and lawyers love to work in areas of gray.
If you're visiting a physician, isn't it always an episode of care?
But that's an excellent point. Not necessarily. And it also depends on the specialty. I mean, obviously, a good example would be if you're an orthopedic physician. and you've set a fracture, a broken arm, broken leg, you know, it's going to be through that episode of care. But you may come back 6 months later or a year later and you're playing football or doing a sport, or if you're like me and you're old and you blow out your back, you got to come back. So it depends on the specialty and what is an episode of care. And a similar, off topic just a little bit, but a similar analogy is when physicians are leaving practices and there becomes an issue as to, well, what patients are mine, what patients are yours. Practice says these are my patients. The physician says, well, I've treated them and I've got the relationship and they're going to go with me. And I've been involved in several cases. And Jim Stroud, I think you and I even talked about it earlier this year, which is what are active patients, which is a little bit different of a dynamic than firing a patient. Now, you wanting to take these patients or leaving the bad ones with the practice. Right. So you send notice just to where the physician is leaving. And that also depends on the specialty. I mean, an active patient or an episode of care, say, for a family practice physician or has a patient that is diabetic, is a little bit harder of a call than, say, the example we just gave with an orthopedic surgeon, which is we've casted your arm and we're going to wait 12 weeks and we're going to release you at the end of 12 weeks. Well, that's a pretty easy episode of care. It's these, you know, the ongoing, diabetics. That's right. Exactly right.
Right.
Now, a question about, because of this poor behavior with their patients, is that kind of why there's this, it seems to be more and more of these VIP or concierge medical practices popping up where they're saying, you know what, I'm going to just have 200 patients and that's it, and they're going to pay a fee. I'll give them all great treatment. Is that kind of a repercussion of that?
That is a repercussion of that. It definitely is. And I have physicians who have moved to that model, even if they didn't join one of the franchise operations right. like MD VIP, but they just said, I'm going to cherry pick.
Right, exactly. I'll get my best ones. I'll give them the best treatment, you know, Ritz-Carlton treatment.
Right.
And I don't have any more problems.
Keep them coming back.
Right. Give them my cell phone.
And it's all good. And just because you want to be a patient, you know, not so fast there, Mrs.
Right.
Ms. Reynos.
You
were mean one day. And you're not getting right. to make the cut. But on the cutting of on the severing of relationships mm-hmm. with patients, Jim, you might speak to the EMTALA thing. Some of my clients that are the single specialty practice in that town will say, if we terminate the relationship, we're just going to see them in the hospital emergency room. They're coming back. They're going to, like a boomerang. And there are laws that prohibit them. I mean, I force the doctors, I guess, to see them once they reach campus.
Yeah, that gets back to that EMTALA that Aaron was referring to earlier. Yeah, and sometimes, you know, the physician is going to be limited as to what they can do. I mean, in the letter, the letter that the physician sends to their patient needs to give the patient an alternative. And in small towns, sometimes there is no alternative because you are the only specialty. EMTALA requires, now, that is a bigger, that is a direct responsibility of a physician, I mean, of the hospital that says, if someone comes to your hospital with an emergency medical condition, you've got to treat that patient. And the hospital fulfills that obligation through its medical staff bylaws requiring physicians of those right. specialties to be on call and come in and treat them. And Jim Stroud, you're right. They may get a phone call because the patient doesn't either, there is no other doctor to go see, or doesn't want to and goes to the ER to get care, and that's an issue. And sometimes they come back. Now, the physician is caught in a horrible predicament because here's this patient that they just terminated the relationship with, and the physician now has an obligation pursuant to the medical staff bylaws that if they don't show up, that they'll have issues or they'll have actions taken against their privileges at the hospital. Or, and this is the one area where CMS will really come in and hammer the doctor, and I've been involved in several of these cases, usually on the hospital side of things, but where the physician didn't come in and take call or didn't treat that patient for that very same reason, and it's one, under the EMTALA rules, it's the one area where the government can come in and actually fine the physicians. Typically, it's going to be a fine on the hospital if the hospital doesn't fulfill right. its obligations, but in this case, so the physician, you're right back where you started from in those cases.
So the physician thinks they've broken up, but the patient's like, oh, we didn't break up. And they go to the hospital, and they're like, that's my doctor. And the doctor's like, they're not a patient anymore.
And that is getting back to why it's got to be documented. And you got to document it pursuant to a letter, and just don't put it in the mail because the patient is going to say, I never got it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So certified. It's got to be certified mail, return receipt requested, or FedEx, or somehow where you prove evidence that that person
delivery.
That,
that
you have severed the relationship.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, back, I want to go back, Jim Stroud, to the you made a comment about somebody having five people not show up. So, and then you do some due diligence and figure out kind of the background of those individuals, and maybe they fall in the same category. What are some things that the physicians can do to make sure that they don't have that kind of day?
Well, there are several. One is that if you know that this patient has a history or this situation of patient has a history, you can double book or triple book so that at least you got a chance that one person shows up. Some practices charge a no-charge fee for missing an appointment without a 24-hour notification. And that's particularly relevant when there's a procedure involved. Because if you have a nuclear camera, if you're a cardiology practice, you have a nuclear camera, which is a very expensive piece of equipment, a nuclear technician, which is a very highly paid person, and certain drugs or reagents that are used in an isotope that's used in that process that is painfully expensive, that has a short shelf life, you have to be paid something. So some practices will say, you're going to need to pay us $100 in advance to schedule the procedure. We do not want to keep your $100. We want you to show up for the appointment. So everything you pay us applies to the cost of the treatment when you show, but if you don't show, we keep the $100. The first specialty in which I heard of this prepayment, of course, plastic surgery has done it for years. If you schedule a plastic surgery right. case, you pay before you have it. OBGYNs, you know, you pay over the first 7 months before you
say,
have
yeah.
your baby.
And yeah. I paid... I don't know, a couple $100 before I had the baby.
Right.
Before I could go to the hospital.
Right. And then urologists, apparently men will no-show a vasectomy appointment with some regularity at the last-minute decision to not go. So making them pay in advance, maybe they decide to go drink a beer and forego the $100, but at least they lost the $100 in the process. But there's more and more effort at trying to get patients to be compliant with that which the patient said they would do. And sometimes it's the physician's fault. The physician might say, you know, Mr. Stroud, I'd like to see you back here in about 60 days. Make an appointment. And if you're better, then that's okay. Just call and cancel. Well, all Mr. Stroud does is forget to call and cancel.
Right.
So the doctors need to not set themselves up for that kind of failure.
So, I mean, is there anything that they, any guidelines they have to follow? Or this is just something as their group of physicians, they can decide, no, we're going to have a prepayment. Policy.
They can decide it.
There's nobody else that they need to talk to. So well, it would seem simple that they should just implement that.
With Medicare patients, there are limitations.
Oh,
you can't
okay.
you can't have fees for non-showing, and that you have to abide by the Medicare rules.
Okay.
But on the private payers, you can set
so
your
they'd
own
have
rules.
To look at the percentage of the patients that they have and where they're getting their income. As far as the physicians getting paid.
And I wouldn't avoid doing a procedure just because you can't do it with a particular class of patients. I do it with all the ones that I could. And, you know, gain at least train that group to comply
okay.
so that you have fewer non-compliant.
Well, one of the other things that we had talked about whenever we were just kind of chatting prior to this was, and I wanted to get into it more during the session, was, you know, the hiring of physicians into your practice. And Jim Hoover, I know you had commented that you thought that was one area maybe they didn't look deeply enough into. Do you have any thoughts for our listeners about that?
Well, I will say the reason why I even mentioned that is because by the time I get involved – relationships have gotten so deteriorated, and you know everybody has the best of intentions when they're starting a relationship, and they think, well, this will never go south. But when it goes south, and usually it's between physician groups, and they're having an ugly business divorce, or the physician is a disruptive physician, the other physicians in the practice look at each other and say, well, I thought you were going to do a background check, or I thought you were going to look at health grades, and it always surprises me with how much time and effort. You know, maybe the office manager or the HR manager in the group or the practice or the hospital will spend reviewing and researching the background of nurses and
right,
the staff.
The front desk person.
Yeah, that's right, and won't look at the doctor. And, you know, typically there's some signs about a doctor moving around a lot. If the doctor's moved around a lot, there's a certain personality that about every 5 years, if the doctor's looking to make a move, it's because that doctor's worn out his or her welcome. And it just always surprises me with how little time the physicians, and whether it's a merger or it's a hiring of a physician, how little time that they will look to get.
What are some common things that they can, I mean, are there places that they can, like Google research? I mean, what is it you would
go
recommend?
Go to Facebook.
Yeah.
Well, some of the issues, and that's part of the problem. their peer review information is highly confidential. So
when
there's information submitted to the various state board of medical examiners or to the National Practitioner Data Bank, which is if there is a, which to me, no physician wants to have a report to the National Practitioner Data Bank. If it goes, it's typically highly confidential. Now, if some credentialing purposes, you can get a hold of that, some of that information. But so that becomes somewhat difficult because it's so confidential, but there's health grades. I mean, there's plenty of ways to look at. There's information out there where you can see that patients are nowadays, and it's kind of getting back to Jim's point, are very quick to tell you if they're unhappy. And not only are they going to tell the physician and the physician staff they're unhappy, they're going to tell the whole world on either, you know, the health grades or in various and sundry chat rooms or places out there that this doctor is a horrible doctor. And of course, you know, the doctors are in a hard position that, well, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, could be me and maybe just the patient's misunderstanding. But there's enough information that at least you can have an understanding that, okay, you know, maybe this doctor has personality issues or some behavioral issues. You know, obviously and historically, not necessarily obviously, but historically, the doctors are the best clinically capable doctors are the ones that are given the greatest leeway behaviorally. Mm. Or they're the highest admitters. They're the ones that can be the tyrants and stab people, you know, with a staple gun.
Well, I think social media might be a great equalizer in this. If they just Google the doctor, you'd be surprised the stuff that's going
to
pop up.
Well, can't they reach out to their colleagues? I'm sure, I mean, they're busy.
But there's
and
probably
don't have
a
time,
lot of rules about that.
Oh, can
social
they?
Media is
well, and there's
less
lawsuits,
rules.
And you got to be careful. You know, there's lawyers. I can't believe these lawyers out there is slander and defamation and all that other type of stuff. See, the doctors are a little bit hesitant of what they say, and that kind of gets back to the, in any type of industry. You know, the recommendations that you give, yeah, so-and-so worked here from such and such a time to, you know, November 2011.
Right.
That's about all you get.
Yeah, we covered that, Aaron, remember?
I do remember in that previous session, yes.
And, Aaron, there is a built-in disadvantage for the physicians in that the patient can say whatever the patient wishes to say in whatever media they wish.
Right.
But privacy dictates that
the physician
cannot
argue back, right?
Cannot argue back. And so in a social media setting, even like ratemds.com, and that's anonymous. The patients don't have to put their names in there and usually don't. So they just massacre the doctors if they're mad. The happy ones rarely make a post. The very unhappy ones will almost always.
I think that doctors are going to have to at least participate in that in the sense they encourage their patients to participate in social media to give them a voice, the good ones.
We have practices that are encouraging their patients.
Right.
If you're a happy patient, would you please make a posting? Here are several
websites.
It makes
a big difference. I know. Look, I mean, I'm sure we've all used it to go to a restaurant. You go to a restaurant. If there's 50 reviews that say it's good, you're going to go.
Husband lives, eats, breathes, and dies by reviews.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Everything he does, he wants to read the reviews first.
Yeah. I mean, it may not be fair to the doctor if you get one irate person that's a loudmouth and spends their whole day online.
Yep. But, well, gentlemen, we're getting near the end of our show, and it's a tradition on our show that when we come to the near the end of the discussion that we ask for a last request of me, that I ask of you. So my last request would be, if you could offer one piece of advice for our listeners, what would it be? Jim Stroud?
To the point about the recruiting and merger situation in a medical practice, I would say this. It's a perfect storm. We have an increasing overhead burden. We have an aging physician population, and we have some pretty hurried marriages that are being formed by recruitment of doctors out of residency or mergers with other practices in town or affiliation with the hospital. Physicians need to know that clinically they are a good fit with a candidate to whom they're talking, that behaviorally they're a good fit with a candidate, that work ethic-wise they're a good fit, and then financially it'll work out. The recruited physician only wants to know, how much am I going to be paid? And when do I become a partner? It's incumbent on upon the practice to know all these other things and to make sure that if they don't permit profanity in the office and the new doctor is profane in every sentence, then it will not work out. And you can't always tell in that one dinner meeting where you go and talk. And many times the recruited physician does not bring their spouse. And you have to have the spouse there because the spouse may be the CEO, the chief emotional officer of the household. And if your recruited doctor turns to his spouse and says, what should I order? You know that you might as well be dealing with his spouse or her spouse because that's where the power is at home. It just, the recruitment effort needs, you used the word due diligence a minute ago, Aaron. It needs a lot more due diligence than it customarily gets.
Okay. How about you, Jim?
Well, I don't know that I could say it better. I know my wife is the decision maker in my home. But I couldn't say it better than what Jim said. I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to make sure it's a good fit. Now, I will say this. The narcissistic personality is very good at covering up for 25, 30 minutes to an hour, maybe even a weekend visit about how this person's a great, great person. And within about 2 weeks or 3 weeks of joining the practice and starting to work, it becomes evident that this physician is not the person that we thought he or she was.
Has an MDity complex.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. But, you know, in those circumstances, I'm involved in the case right now. I'm not going to get into the specifics, but it didn't fit. And the practice did an excellent job of documenting all the patient complaints and all the reasons why this wasn't working out. Because it's going to be that same narcissistic personality that's going to come back after the group and say, well, how dare you? And, you know, they tend to back down when you start presenting the evidence. At least you present the evidence to their lawyers, and then that physician gets the bill from his or her lawyer. They tend to back down eventually.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Great discussion today. Should any of you have any questions for Jim Stroud or Jim Hoover, please visit www.resultsmatterradio.com. You will find their direct contact information on our site. If you are listening to us through podcast or via resultsmatterradio.com, please remember to visit the site next week as we will have a new show up and running for you. Thank you again to our guests and to my co-host Lee. On behalf of Byrne Foreman, a full-service law firm with offices across the Southeast, we'd like to remind you, if results matter to you and you want them to matter to your law firm, please give us a call. You can visit our website to find the right attorney for you at www.byrne.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day, folks.
Thank you.